From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio.
Welcome to the 70th episode of NIH Research Radio with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Joe Balinfi, and coming up in this episode, we kick off Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month with an in-depth interview about the latest research and treatments. But first, we have two reports on pelvic disorders. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
Here's a song that means a lot to me. I hope you enjoy it. Well, I remember. Sorry about that. Let me catch my breath for a second. Well, hold on there.
If you have a chronic cough, wheezing, emphysema, or other trouble breathing, you might actually have something more. COPD. It's the number four cause of death in America. Few people have heard of it, including those who actually have it.
Take it away, Jim.
COPD can be treated. A simple breathing test can help you find out if you have it. So talk to your doctor about COPD. Get the test. Start getting the right treatment.
Thank you very much.
Learn more. Breathe better. Go to www.learnaboutcopd.org. A message from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
There are a variety of problems related to the pelvic floor. We find out in this report from Wally Akinzo that about a quarter of women are affected with one of these disorders at some point in her lifetime.
Nearly 24% of U.S. women are affected with one or more pelvic floor disorders. According to a National Institutes of Health study, Dr. Susan Meikle is the project scientist for the NIH Pelvic Floor Disorders Network.
Pelvic floor disorders are a group of disorders that have to do with the supporting muscle and tissue of the pelvis.
Dr. Meikle explains that these muscles and ligaments form a sling across the opening of a woman's pelvis, holding the bladder, uterus, bowel, and rectum in place.
So when there's a weakness or a tear, say from a vaginal delivery, a birth, the bladder can kind of actually fall down. The uterus can fall down. Intestines can fall down through different kinds of spaces between the muscles and the thick connective tissue.
Funded by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, and the Office of Research on Women's Health, researchers used data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Dr. Meikle explains what the survey shows.
The results were that it is quite common for women in the United States to have symptoms of at least one pelvic floor disorder. Overall, almost 24% of women had symptoms of at least one pelvic floor disorder, and the most common was urinary incontinence, followed by fecal incontinence, and then the least common was the symptomatic pelvic organ prolapse, which is feeling the organs in a place that they're not supposed to be.
Dr. Meikle highlights the importance of the findings.
What it underscores is that this is a big public health problem. It really lays the groundwork for trying to do more research on prevention because it is actually common.
Treatment for pelvic floor disorders varies with the severity of symptoms. Dr. Meikle says treatment may involve behavioral therapies, exercises to strengthen muscles, vaginal devices to hold up the bladder or other pelvic organs, medications, or surgery. This is Wally Akinzo at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
From pelvic floor to pelvic pain, here's another report from Wally Akinzo focusing on that area between the hip and belly button.
Urologic pain disorders such as interstitial cystitis and chronic prostatitis have been assumed to be bladder and prostate problems. However, no other causes have been identified, and there is no uniformly effective treatment for either disorder. That's why the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases will launch a new research network which will help conduct collaborative studies of urologic chronic pelvic pain disorders by looking for clues outside the bladder and prostate. Dr. Leroy Nyberg, NIDDK's Director of Urology Programs at the Division of Kidney, Urologic, and Hematologic Diseases, talks about how this research network came to pass.
What makes this unique is that before these two disorders, interstitial cystitis and chronic prostatitis, have been studied mainly by urologists. We at the NIH have been studying them for years and really have not been able to get a foothold on what causes them or what is the most effective way to treat them. So we have decided that we have to look outside of the specialty of urology and enlist other investigators to look at these diseases as well.
The research network, Multidisciplinary Approach to the Study of Chronic Pelvic Pain, known by the acronym MAP, requires investigators to conduct highly collaborative research of the most common urologic pelvic pain syndromes from a broadened systemic perspective. Dr. Nyberg says MAP will help address many persistent questions about urologic chronic pain disorders.
The MAP research is to find the underlying basic causes of this disorder by taking samples of bladder and prostate and finding it, whether we can find it in the blood as some sort of an abnormal substance which is found in the blood or in the urine.
Dr. Nyberg is optimistic about what this program can lead to down the road.
Ideally, we would like to say that we can find the cause and we can prevent these disorders, the chronic pelvic pain disorders, and we can effectively treat them. But basically, we would hope that first it leads to a greater understanding of what are some of the causes of the disorder. Once we find a cause or what changes occur in the body, we can start to target medications and effective therapy.
Recent studies have shown that interstitial cystitis and chronic prostatitis are frequently associated with other chronic pain disorders such as chronic fatigue syndrome and irritable bowel syndrome. For more information on MAP, visit www.niddk.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Coming up next, the latest on Alzheimer's disease. Stay tuned.
If you could see plaque clogging your arteries, you'd floss them. If you could see a cramped heart muscle, you'd massage it. If you could see a blood clot forming, you'd wash it out. If you could see heart disease, the number one killer of women, you'd see your doctor. The hard truth is, what you can't see can hurt you. Heart disease can lead to heart attack, disability, even death. Don't wait until it's too late. Talk to your doctor, find out your risk, and take action today to lower it. Learn the hard truth. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Scientists think that as many as 4.5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's disease. With November being Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month, we're featuring an interview with an expert on the topic, Dr. Lori Ryan with the National Institute on Aging. We started by asking Dr. Ryan for a refresher on what exactly is Alzheimer's disease.
Actually, Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia. Actually, it's the most common form of dementia in those who are over the age of 65. And dementia simply is a term that means you have a loss of cognitive function, of memory and thinking skills. It deteriorates over time.
Are the number of cases of Alzheimer's disease increasing?
Yes. Unfortunately, because the population is getting older and age is the biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's, we are seeing more people, and that trend's only going to continue unless we find a treatment that either stops or slows the progression of the disease.
So, Dr. Ryan, what kind of treatments are available for Alzheimer's disease?
Currently, what we have available for patients are drugs that work on the symptoms. They're called acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, Aricept, people might have heard of, Exelon. And those drugs treat symptoms. They don't stop the underlying disease pathology, though. And so what's exciting now is it's in early stage human trials, phase one and phase two, where drugs are actually trying to target the underlying disease to stop or slow the progression of the illness.
You mentioned phase one and two trials as early phases. Can you explain that?
So in the first early phases of clinical trials, phase one is really for safety. Phase two, they want to look at safety and dosing of the drug, and as well as some effectiveness. And then phase three are really the big test for the drugs. They have to go into a lot of patients and see if they're if they're effective.
So Dr. Ryan, are there some new or early trials going on now that may shed more light on Alzheimer's disease?
Oh, absolutely. The interesting thing now is, we're finding out more about the disease mechanism. So the basic science has really helped us to identify a couple of areas that we want to target. One is the beta amyloid protein, which has an abnormal buildup in the brain. And the other one is the tau protein. And now there are new phase two, early phase clinical trials actually targeting both of these mechanisms. So one exciting thing that just came out of a recent international Alzheimer's conference looked at a drug that actually targets the tau protein and stops it from aggregating or building up in the brain abnormally.
Can you explain more about how Alzheimer's disease works and how these drugs treat the disease?
Well, basically, like I said, both the tau protein and the beta amyloid protein abnormally aggregate or clump up in the brain, and they cause what we call the hallmark signs of Alzheimer's, are these plaques, which are the beta amyloid buildup, and tangles, which are the tau. So we're looking at drugs that basically will come in and either stop the proteins from aggregating abnormally and having the dementia associated with Alzheimer's, or clearing them out of the body so that they clear out. Normally they clear out and they don't build up to these levels in the brain.
What exactly are these drugs and how do they work?
So this tau aggregation inhibitor, it's called REMBER, actually is the trademark name of it. It's an old drug, actually, that was used to treat urinary tract infections, methylene blue. Turns out it also, in test tubes and in animals, it breaks up the tangles, the tau protein. Another interesting one is called Dimebon. It actually is an antihistamine, another older drug. And it was used in Russia primarily, and they've actually done an early phase trial there, again, a phase two. They did it in Russia, not in the U.S., but a lot of the investigators were from the United States. And they found that it actually, not only did the cognition stop declining in patients who had Alzheimer's disease, it was mild to moderate Alzheimer's, but it actually got better.
Other than drugs or medications, what kinds of other things are being researched as possible treatments for Alzheimer's disease?
I think some of the other interesting things are looking at diet and exercise. We have known for a long time from observational studies that people who have healthy lifestyles, who are not obese, who are not diabetic, who have healthy diets like the Mediterranean diet, for example, actually show less or later onset of Alzheimer's and less Alzheimer's than people who have the high-fat, more Western diet, if you will.
Are there studies looking at other kinds of treatment?
There was another very interesting one of a nutritional drink, Suvinard, where they gave a mixed combination of things like omega-3 fatty acids and antioxidants. And so it's highly nutritious. They gave it to a group of patients, and again, mild Alzheimer's, and they actually found that there was slowing of the progression of the illness. So again, these are early phase studies, but very promising, and also very promising for prevention, which is what we ultimately want to do, is we want to stop people from getting the disease, which means that if we can target lifestyle, and it seems midlife is particularly critical. Another study found that diabetes at midlife puts you at greatest risk of having Alzheimer's later on than even if you had diabetes as an older adult. So it seemed like that midlife period was very critical. So if we can, potentially intervene there, we may be able to at least slow the progression of this illness, which if we did that would save, obviously people's lives would be much improved, and also the economic costs, which are going to be tremendous, of caring for people with Alzheimer's would also be lessened.
Dr. Ryan, what other areas of research are being explored to help fight this disease?
The other very interesting area is diagnostics and early detection. We are making great strides now with imaging and also biological markers in human blood and in cerebral spinal fluid of the underlying Alzheimer's pathology. And they're finding that we can actually look early on, you know, people at least with this mild cognitive impairment stage, and hopefully move it even further back to identify people who are at risk. And also, these biomarkers, as we call them, will also be helpful for treatment trials. We would be able to see if there were changes, something like you might see in cholesterol in somebody with heart disease, and so that you wouldn't have to wait, you know, years to see if you're slowing down the progression of the cognitive changes, which are not quick. They're actually fairly slow over time. So if we had a marker in blood or in spinal fluid or even imaging or a combination, we would be able to see if drugs were working faster and hopefully find out sooner whether or not they were working, and also find out who might be the people to respond to the drugs.
Where can people find more information about the disease, research, treatment, and trials?
So one of the best is actually the NIA's own website, which is the Alzheimer's Disease Education and Referral Center, ADEER. And that website has a host of information from what clinical trials are available to information to help patients and family members with the disease, to professionals who may be looking for information. So it's truly a very useful website, and it's up to date. So I would encourage people to look at the NIA's ADEER website.
Thanks to Dr. Lori Ryan at the National Institute on Aging. The website she mentioned is www.nia.nih.gov/Alzheimer's. You can also call the ADEER Center at 1-800-438-4380. Be sure to ask for or look up the new publication, Alzheimer's Disease, Unraveling the Mystery. And that's it for this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us again on Friday, November 14th, when our next edition will be available for download. I'm your host, Joe Belinfi. Thanks for listening. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, and the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.